Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. September 1955, Neely Buchanan, a trustee at the State Prison of Southern Michigan, was denied parole. Because of his trustee status, he was assigned to pick up local trash from area farms in a prison truck, which provided the perfect opportunity to escape. Running out of gas near Stockbridge, Michigan, and continuing on foot, he hid out inside the barn of Howard and Myra Herrick, an elderly farm couple. Buchanan was planning to steal their car to further his escape. Surprised when Howard Herrick returned early, he killed the elderly man by crushing his skull with a hand grinder. Hearing the commotion in the barn, Myra Herrick came in and was viciously bludgeoned to death next to her husband. Their killer quickly hid their bodies under bales of hay, and Buchanan hitchhiked to Mason, caught a cab to Lansing, and bought a bus ticket and fled to New York using Howard Herrick's identity. Thinking Buchanan was still in the area, fearful residents armed themselves and looked upon strangers with suspicion. Ingham County Sheriff William Willard Barnes led the hunt for the killer, searching for months, but the investigation came to a dead end. Harry Doesburg, a neighbor to the Herricks, raised a $3,000 reward, much of it his own money, to find the killer. Doesburg sent wanted posters across the country and paid for wanted ads in various newspapers and magazines. 13 months later, an informant in Baltimore recognized Buchanan from a wanted ad in a magazine and turned him in. Buchanan was quickly returned to Michigan, signed a confession, pled guilty, and was sentenced to life in prison, all within a 72-hour period. 10 years after his sentence, Neely began appealing his conviction on numerous grounds, including police misconduct, racial threats, and improper court proceedings. For 25 years, Neely had not been represented. The book that we're featuring this evening is A Slayer Waits, the true story of a Michigan double murder, with my special guest, journalist and author, Rod Sadler. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Rod Sadler.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate you having me on here, and I'm looking forward to it.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much. To Hell I Must Go, it was last time. That was a very fascinating book. Let's get to this story. How did you come to want to or need to write A Slayer Waits?
It actually began in the 1960s. Not necessarily my desire to write about it, but I grew up in Ingham County, Michigan, in the 1960s, and we lived, I'm going to say probably 15 miles from Stockbridge, a small town in the southwest corner, the southeast corner of Ingham County. And I remember driving with my folks, and they pointed out a barn one day, and they said, that's where that couple was killed. Well, you know what, as a kid who's 7 or 8 or 9 years old, you hear about that, and I glanced over at the barn, and I always remembered that barn for some reason. And then I forgot about it. I forgot about it for the rest of my life until a couple years ago. I'm a consultant on the side, and I was chatting with an attorney that I knew, and he happened to mention that he had used to work for the Ingham County Prosecutor's Office in the 1970s and that he had handled an appeal for this particular killer. Well, I remembered the case very vividly. I remembered that day driving up M52 and my parents pointing out that barn. And he began to go into all these points that the killer had made in an attempt to appeal his conviction. And I had just decided that I had already published my first book, and since I had a contact there that knew a lot about it, maybe this would be an interesting second book. And so that's how it kind of all started.
Now, tell us a little bit about this area that we're talking about that's featured in this story. Describe this general area in southern Michigan.
Well, Ingham County is located in the center of the state. As you know, Michigan is shaped like a mitten, and if you were in just about in the center of the state, you would find Ingham County. It's the state capital is Lansing, and that's located in the northwest corner of Ingham County. There's some small towns in around the county and villages. On the western side, you have Mason, which is actually the county seat. I misspoke myself. Mason is the county seat, but the circuit court for Ingham County is both in Mason and Lansing both. There's a small town south of that called Leslie. Along the center of the county is Williamston, and then along the east side of the county is a small town called Weberville, and then if you go to the southeastern corner of the county, there's a small town called Stockbridge. These small towns in 1955, as you can imagine, if you're older, I guess the best way to describe it, and I was trying to think of a way to describe it on the way in here tonight, if you could think of the town of Mayberry, you know, life was a lot easier back then, or seemed that way anyway, to those of us nowadays. But deals were made on handshakes. Strangers were welcomed with open arms. People left their doors unlocked. You know, families got together for picnics, and whole communities got together for picnics and Sunday dinners. And it was a lot easier time back then, and Ingham County was no exception, nor was Stockbridge. It was just an easy way of life back then, and you know, the country was recovering from World War II and the Korean War. The economy was booming. It was just really a good time to be alive. On the flip side of that, there was also the civil rights movement that was just starting, and the book touches on that to some degree. But all in all, Ingham County was a nice place to grow up, a nice place to live back in 1955.
Now let's talk about the character, the main character in this story, Neely Buchanan. And you talk about, as you do in the book, his father Porter and his mother Gladys, and he's one of seven children. He's the first child. So tell us about his life before we get to his teen life, where it seems things go off the rail. But let's talk about his early life and what his family life was characterized by. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, his early life, there wasn't a whole lot of information available on that. I will tell you that he was born in Alabama. I suspect that his family was lower income. And it didn't take very long. By the age of I want to say 6 or 7 years old, they had already moved to Michigan. They had at one point lived down in Monroe, which is along the state line with Ohio, and they subsequently ended up in the town of Flint. I'm sure you're familiar with the Flint water crisis right now, but that's where they ended up. And he was well-liked by the neighbors, by the people that he grew up with in that area. All of his neighbors liked him. But he eventually got into trouble at a young age. And it started, you know, with small thefts and things like that, even at a young age, before he became a teenager. And that's when his life really took a turn. And I think that's really when it all began.
You talk about him being deemed incorrigible at 15 after assaulting his father, and he went to a place that was first called the Industrial School for Boys, later Boys Vocational School. He arrived there in 1940. Describe as you do the conditions at this school.
The conditions at the Boys Vocational Training School, or whatever you choose to call it, because the names changed quite frequently, but that actually was built in the 1800s, and it was essentially a correctional institution for young men. It actually began as a co-ed facility back in the 1800s, but quickly turned to males only. The kids lived in dorms. There were dorms, small dorms scattered around the campus, if you will. It really resembled like a large church or big business building, if you will. It's a large brick building, and had these small cottages all around. And each day, the kids went through a regimented routine, and that included calisthenics. It included marching three times a day in formation. It included classroom sessions. The kids were given specific jobs to do. And beyond that, the troubled kids, those that didn't go along with the program, were punished in one way or another. And the one that sticks out the most to me is that they were forced to stand on a line for hours on end. And that was a sort of punishment. They had a cabin, number 5, I believe it was, that was used specifically for punishment, and those were the severe cases. A lot of times the kids that ended up in number 5, as they called it, would end up trying to burn mattresses or causing damage to the building or screaming, yelling, assaultive behavior, things like that. So that was kind of the atmosphere, if you will, around the Boys Vocational Training School. It was actually located in Lansing. It was located on Pennsylvania near Shiawassee Street. And it was a big facility. Even into the 1970s, when it was still open, the Lansing Police Department would frequently get calls of runaways from that particular facility until it was eventually closed. There was a report issued back in the 1940s, actually while Buchanan was still there, that said all of the types of punishment that were going on there needed to stop. That wasn't the way that facility was intended. And it was shortly thereafter that Buchanan got out of there. But I don't know if that sets the stage well enough, but I don't think it was a very pleasant place to be.
You talk about that he was released in a couple years, and what happens is that he's soon after got 7 more charges. So how does his tell us what he does to avoid these charges and further incarceration? What does he do?
Well, he got out, and you have to understand that the intention of the Boys Vocational Training School was for the child to be rehabilitated to the point where he could be returned into society. And so when Neely was eventually released, he began to get in trouble again, and he eventually joined the service to avoid prosecution or to avoid jail time. And so he joined the service, and during World War II, he served over in Europe. And he actually drove an ammunition truck over in Europe for 2 or 3 years. And he was released from the Army, had an honorable discharge, and came back to the States. He had met his wife while he was in the Army and was married, and came back. They moved to the Detroit area, and he began trying to support her and ended up getting back into trouble again.
You talk about the kind of trouble that he got in. If we go just slightly backwards, what he does is he has to rejoin the military after 3 years in the military because he's convicted of Peeping Tom offenses.
So he rejoins
the military again.
Yeah, he was convicted of being a Peeping Tom. There was some theft charges in there. And I think back then they based it a lot also on maybe his juvenile record too, the assaultive behavior toward his father, the petty thefts, the driving without a driver's license, things like that. It got to the point where they said, look, you either rejoin the military or you're going back to jail. And so he did rejoin the military.
Now, you talk about he got married and met his wife in 1946, and then 1949 he married Jeanette. And in 1952, he's convicted of armed robbery, 2 to 4 years, $12 from a cabbie, and he'd just been laid off. And you say that at this age, 28 years old, 210-pound auto mechanic, started his sentence, and his wife Jeanette said, see you later.
That's right. She did not... At least according to the records that I found, she did not communicate with him once he was convicted of that armed robbery. He had been fired from a job as a window washer. And I honestly believe he was probably trying to get money for his family. But he did an armed robbery of a cab driver in the town of Inkster, Michigan, down by Detroit. And he was quickly convicted. And he was sentenced to the state prison of Southern Michigan, which is today known as Jackson Prison, which is the world's largest walled institution. And it's not a very nice place to be. And so when he got sentenced to prison, he did his time, and he got paroled. He was allowed out on parole, and it was shortly after his release on parole that he chose to break into a Chevy dealership called Funston Chevrolet in Detroit. And he was quickly caught. And I have to admit, I don't know if he was caught inside the building, but he was caught immediately. And he knew he was going back to prison. He knew that he'd have to go back before a judge and that the judge wouldn't be happy because he was out on parole at the time. And the judge quickly sentenced him to 1 to 15 years in prison for the break-in at Funston Chevrolet. And said at the same time that when he completed that, he should complete serving his sentence for the armed robbery in Inkster also. So he was facing some serious time. But to him, he figured, hey, if I watch my P's and Q's, if I do what I'm told, maybe I can get paroled again. And that's what his plan was, to get paroled a second time.
Now, he did everything, as you are alluding to, he was a model prisoner. He did everything he possibly could to stay out of the way and not get any negative attention, and I guess planned as he knew that you have to for parole, to be eligible for parole. So tell us about the parole hearing and its result.
Well, what had happened was he figured he could do his time. As soon as he could, as soon as he would be eligible for parole, he would apply for it. And he would likely get a parole hearing. Well, he had only been serving about 10 months into his second prison sentence, and he was allowed, applied for, and was given a parole hearing. He didn't know what to expect in that parole hearing, and so he went in before the parole board, and they determined that it was just too soon for him. He'd only been back in prison for 10 months. He had been paroled before and had done a break-in, and so they decided, no, you need to spend a little bit more time. And so they said, your parole is denied, and they told him that he would not be able to reapply for parole for at least 2 years. This occurred on September, it was late August or like September 1st, 1955. It was literally 2 days before he ended up escaping from the prison. He had already been given, in that short 10 months that he'd been back in prison, he had already earned trustee status, which allowed him to be housed outside the prison walls and to do menial tasks. He was allowed to use a prison truck, go around to the local farms and pick up garbage from the local farms, and then he would bring that back to the prison, and that would be given to the hogs that the prisoners raised. Jackson Prison, or the State Prison of Southern Michigan at that time, really was a city within itself. They grew their own produce, they raised their own farm animals, they had wood shops, things like that. So it really was a city within itself. And the whole purpose of Neely Buchanan being allowed out as a parolee to pick up the trash was simply to bring it back, and it would be fed to the hogs and the livestock that they were raising within the prison.
Now, you talk about the history of escapes at this prison. We won't go into some of the more sensational ones, but tell us about just its ability to secure its inmates, its track record on that in its history.
You know, I didn't find a whole lot of information on that. That I did find, I garnered from the former director of the Michigan Department of Corrections, a guy by the name of Perry Johnson, who wrote an outstanding book called Jackson, The Rise and Fall of the World's Largest Prison. He talks briefly in his book, and we had lunch together, and he shared some of the escape stories with me. But it was very, very difficult back then, it seemed like, to keep track of the prisoners. It seemed that there was frequently walkaways. They were very creative in how they escaped. Some would hide in crates and boxes and, you know, be carried out on trucks. Some of them crawled through prisons. A couple of them actually took over a guard tower and actually ended up in a shootout with the prison guards prior to this. And that it seemed as if, at least in the communities around Jackson, that the local residents were always calling in about escapees. The press was always talking about the escapees from the prison, and it just didn't seem that a lot was being done about that at the time. And that became a real issue, especially after the murders of Howard and Myra Herrick.
Now, talk about the plan that Neely Buchanan has to escape and how he does it, and tell us then a little bit about Howard and Myra Herrick and in their little place of Stockbridge Township.
Well, Neely decided that he would have no part of the parole board's decision, that he would have to wait 2 years. He wanted to see his family, and the only reason that I know that is I had the opportunity to interview his appellate attorney and we'll get into that a little bit later in the interview, but who is actually still practicing law, and he shared a lot of information with me that he was allowed to. But Neely wanted to get back with his family. He missed his wife. and he had two little girls by that time, and they were very, very young. I think one was, the oldest was three at the time, and the youngest was probably born either just before he went back to prison or shortly thereafter. But he set up to take the prison truck out and get the pick up the trash from the local farms. And he set out one morning, and he never turned back. He had a prison truck at his disposal, and he was supposed to be outside. He was supposed to be away from the prison, and he figured it would be a while before they noticed whether or not he came back. So he started north from Jackson along his route, picking up the trash, and he got to the small town of Stockbridge in the southeast corner of Ingham County. And the truck was getting low on gas, and so rather than run out of gas on a roadway and be more noticeable, he ditched it at the local high school in Stockbridge. And he set out on foot. It was still dark out when he abandoned it at the high school. And he set out walking north, kind of paralleling the state highway. At that time, it was M-92. And he walked through woods and fields all day. While he's doing that, about 4 miles north of Stockbridge, there was a small farm, and it was owned by an elderly couple. And I say elderly, I have to apologize for that. I'm 56 yeah. years old, and I think that Mr. and Mrs. Herrick were in their mid-60s, so they weren't really much older than me.
Oh.
And I don't consider myself elderly, but beyond that, they lived on this farm of 80 acres, and it was all land. There was only their farmhouse and a barn. And this was the farm that Myra Herrick had been born in. Her parents lived there. She had lived there all of her life until she met Howard, and they were married. And she moved out. Once her parents passed away, Howard and her moved back into that home. And they had lived there and had raised their children there. Their children were adults, were moved out of the house. So Howard and Myra lived there by themselves. Howard was a retired chicken farmer. He still had a brood of chickens in the barn on the lower level. And every Sunday, the entire family would come over to the Herrick farm, and they'd have a big meal, and the kids would play in the barn and jump off the hay, and the parents would sit down on the front porch and swap stories, and it was sort of a, I don't know how else to describe it other than to tell you maybe a Norman Rockwell painting, if you will. It was just an easier time back then. So Howard and Myra lived there. Across the street from Howard and Myra's house was a little general store. It was owned by a guy by the name of Harry Dosberg. Harry lived there with his wife, and they had little grocery items in their store. They had cold cuts. They sold gas. And then north of there, about 2 miles, was the very small village, and I say small because it was another general store, a church, and a school, and it was called the village of Millville. So that was 2 miles north of Howard and Myra's home and Harry Dosberg's store. The state highway, M-92, which eventually became M-52, ran north and south between Stockbridge and another town into the next county called Perry. And it was just a really simpler time back then. So Neely Buchanan sets off walking through the woods and the fields, and he walks all day. He's trying to stay concealed. He knows they're going to eventually find that prison truck, and they do. He abandons it probably around 6 a.m., 5 or 6 a.m., and starts out walking through the woods and the fields. And about 8:30, the sheriff's department gets a call about this abandoned prison truck at the Stockbridge schools. It doesn't take them long to determine that, number one, it shouldn't be there, and number two, the driver's missing. So quick call to the prison. They determined that Neely Buchanan has escaped. And the story continues from there. Neely comes upon the Herrick home after dark that night. He said it was still dark when he got there. And he chose that barn simply because he wanted to rest. He went in there and laid down and figured he was going to sleep. He could see the lights on in the house. And inside the barn was a 52 DeSoto automobile. And he figured the next day when the farmer came out, he would get the keys from him and further his escape from there. He was tired of walking, I guess. And so his plan was to knock out Mr. Herrick and take the keys to the car. So in the barn is a large chopping block that Mr. Herrick used to slaughter his chickens. So Neely Buchanan takes that chopping block and he sets it in the rafters right over where the car is. And he figures the next morning when Mr. Herrick comes in, he will push that off the rafters and he will knock out Mr. Herrick, grab the keys, and take the 52 DeSoto and escape. That's what his plan was. Unfortunately for the Herricks, it didn't turn out that way.
Now, you say that while prison officials are looking for him and hot on his tail in Stockbridge, that he's hiding in the barn and he has this plan. Let's find out what he does and how that plan changes and what happens to the Herricks.
Well, he misses his opportunity to push the chopping block down onto Mr. Herrick. He knows, and he said this in his confession, he knows that when that chopping block hits Mr. Herrick, it's going to kill him. Unfortunately, Neely sets up a wall of hay bales in the barn so that he can conceal himself and sleep. Mr. Herrick comes out, gets in the car, and leaves before Neely has the chance to push the block off. And so he's missed his opportunity. He's got every chance now to just simply leave the barn and continue on foot. But he wants the keys to that car. He knows that Mr. Herrick is going to come back. He knows he's going to have a chance again. So he waits. Well, Mr. Herrick comes back at 3 in the afternoon after leaving his part-time job. Unbeknownst to Neely, Neely is out walking around in the barn because he's bored, and he's looking over Mr. Herrick's tools. And he said in his confession, he said the car was really quiet. And he said he was surprised when the car pulled in and he was standing there. Neely had a hand grinder in his hand, and he was looking at it when Mr. Herrick pulled into the barn. Mr. Herrick always parked his DeSoto inside his barn. And let me back up just a little bit. Just prior to this, Neely's looking around the barn. Mr. Herrick gets back, and it's a Saturday afternoon, and he stops at Harry Dosberg's store across the street. This is something that is routine. He does it every Saturday. Harry Dosberg comes out, doesn't even ask what Mr. Herrick wants because he knows. Howard Herrick is there to have his gas tank filled up. And on the passenger seat of the car, there's always Mr. Herrick's lunch pail, and there's a clean uniform from Wyeth Industries where he worked in Mason. So Howard Herrick pulls into Harry Dosberg's store. They chat a little bit. Harry pokes his head in, talks to Margaret, Harry Dosberg's wife. Margaret says, what are your plans for the weekend? Oh, he says, we're going up north to see some cousins. Oh, that's great. So here, Howard Herrick gets back into his car, drives literally across the street, up around behind the house, and pulls into the barn. And there's Neely Buchanan, standing there with a hand grinder in his hand next to a tool bench. Howard says from inside the car, he says, what are you doing here? Neely Buchanan keeps calm. He says, "I'm just looking at your tools." He says, "I wondered if you wanted to buy this, or if you wanted to sell this." Howard Herrick says, as he's getting out of the car, "No." Well, Howard Herrick was blind in his left eye, and I was never able to determine how that happened. But as he's getting out of his car, and Buchanan says, "Hey, I was wondering if you wanted to sell this." Howard's stepping out of the car. Neely comes across with the hand grinder and hits Howard Herrick in the head, knocking him down to the barn floor and briefly knocking him out. So he puts the hand grinder down and he starts going through Howard Herrick's pockets. And he's looking for his wallet and his money, and he's looking for the keys to the car. About that same time, Mrs. Herrick notices that Howard hasn't come out of the barn. So she goes in to see what's going on, and imagine her surprise when she walks in to see Neely Buchanan kneeling over her husband, who's now unconscious and bleeding, and going through his pockets. She says, "What's going on in here?" Neely grabs a ball-peen hammer and attacks her, and she's able to fend off several blows. The pathologist that did her autopsy found several bruises on her hands and her arms where she was trying to fend off the blows from this ball-peen hammer. Neely Buchanan finally connects with her head and knocks her out, and then hits her again in the head with the ball-peen hammer. Unbeknownst to him, she is still alive, but she's unconscious. About this time now, Howard Herrick comes to, and he starts to get up. So Neely hits him a second time in the head, crushing his skull, and kills him instantly. Now, he's got to decide what to do. He knows that somebody's going to check that barn eventually, so he drags both bodies over into the hay area where the baled hay is stored, and he covers both bodies with bales of hay in an attempt to conceal them. And then he goes back to the car and he rifles around looking for the keys to the car. Unfortunately for him, when Mr. Herrick was getting out of the car and was struck and he fell, the car keys fell under some hay and Neely never found them. So he had to set off and continue his escape on foot.
Now, you talk about how the bodies are discovered the next day. Actually, they're not discovered immediately, and you can tell us why. You talk about the next day and Howard and Myra's son and his involvement and his just routine of coming over and getting some eggs. So tell us what happens the next day
at the Herrick. Yeah, their son lived in the small town of Gregory, which is in Livingston County. It's not too far from Stockbridge. Stockbridge is pretty close to the county line. And so Lester, their son, was coming over to get some eggs because Howard still had a large brood of chickens down in the lower portion of his barn. So he comes over with his wife, and they walk in the back door. The house is unlocked. The windows are open. Everything is normal, except his parents aren't there. That seemed a little bit odd, so he went out to check the barn because he knew that his dad always parked the car in the barn. Well, the car was in the barn. He didn't go up and look in it, but he noticed the car was in the barn. So he figured that they must have left. They must have went somewhere in a hurry with some friends for some reason. And so he talks to his wife, says they must have had to go somewhere. I'll just talk to him tomorrow. He gets the eggs that he needs, and he leaves. The next day, he shows back up, and everything is the same as it was the day before. The car is still in the barn. Parents are nowhere to be found, and he noticed something peculiar. Howard and Myra Herrick had a parakeet. And Mrs. Herrick loved that parakeet. And she fed that bird every day. Except he noticed that the bird hadn't been fed. He knew something was wrong. So he called his brother. And his brother lived on the other side of the county in a small town called Onondaga. And his brother Harold said, yep, something's wrong. Mother would never leave without feeding that parakeet. That something must be wrong. He says, I will meet you at the farm. So he heads out, and on the way to the farm, they swing through Mason, and they stop at the Ingham County Sheriff's Department, and they speak with Captain Versal Babcock, who was the chief of detectives at the time. And Captain Babcock actually knew the Herricks. He had met them the year before, and he agreed. Yeah, something just doesn't sound right. He knew about Neely Buchanan's escape. He knew that the prison truck had been found in Stockbridge. He knew something was wrong at the Herricks. He was starting to put two and two together, but he didn't want to worry the Herrick boys because they hadn't heard, probably hadn't heard about the escapee because they hadn't mentioned it. But he agreed to go over with them to check out the residence. It was now dark out. It was September 3rd. I believe September 3rd was the day they were killed. It was September 5th. He goes over. He checks the house. Everything is in order. Mrs. Herrick's pocketbook is laying on the kitchen table. The windows are open. Parakeet obviously still hasn't been fed. The Herrick boys had checked with Howard and Myra's best friends in Dansville. They said, no, we haven't seen them. So that just added to the concern. So they go out, Captain Babcock and the sons go out, and they begin to check the barn. And one of the boys goes down to check where the chickens are. And he notices some red fluid, dark red fluid on top of one of the chicken cages. And he goes up and he realizes that it's blood and that it has dripped through the floor from above. So he goes back up, and by that time, Captain Babcock and the other son had been searching around with their flashlights, and they discovered sticking out from under one of the hay bales was an arm and a leg, and it was Mr. Herrick's body. And that's essentially how they were discovered. I have to tell you that as they entered the barn, it had been 2 days in extreme heat, and wow. Captain Babcock and the deputy that was with him, they knew, I think, once they entered that barn, what they were going to find, just because of the odor. So as they start to process the scene, they secure the scene, they get help coming, and as they're lifting the hay bale off Mr. Herrick's body, they notice Mrs. Herrick's foot sticking out from under a second hay bale, and then they discover her body also.
Now, as a result of this, with Babcock, the press, the police, is it official that they released that there's a killer on the loose?
They do, and they know who the killer is. And I will tell you that I served as a police officer for 30 years, and there's a certain point where you just know. You just know who the killer is. And in this particular case, inside the barn, they had discovered prison clothing behind the wall of hay bales that Neely had built. So they knew a prison inmate had been in there. They knew that the prison truck had been abandoned 4 miles south of where they were. They knew that it was Neely Buchanan. They just had to prove it. And so They called in the Michigan State Police Crime Laboratory, who came and they lifted a fingerprint from the automobile. Neely had gotten into their Mr. Herrick's DeSoto, and he had pulled the dash panel down near the floor in an attempt to hotwire the car, but he didn't know how to do it. So he just left the car there with his fingerprints on it. They were able to quickly match Buchanan's fingerprint with the fingerprints that were on file with the state because he'd been in prison. And so within a day or two, they knew absolutely, without any doubt, that Neely Buchanan had murdered Howard and Meyer Herrick. That night, that particular night, Sheriff Barnes had been woken up and had gone to the scene, and he ordered his men to start going door to door in the middle of the night to see if anybody remembered anything. Well, the deputy goes over to Harry Dosberg's store, and he begins to ask Dosberg if he's seen anything unusual. Well, Dosberg had seen a black man hitchhiking on Saturday afternoon, and he paid no attention to it. It was a little unusual, but he never thought anything of it. And it was right after Howard had filled his gas tank there. Shortly after Howard left the gas station, or Harry Dosberg's store, his wife was working, and she suddenly heard some screaming. And she thought it was unusual, but she knew that Howard and Myra Herrick were hard of hearing, and so she figured it was their television. She never realized at the time that it was Howard and Myra Herrick being bludgeoned to death. She was listening to her neighbors being killed. So when the deputy shows up in the middle of the night, he begins to question Harry Dosberg, asking him if he saw anything, telling him that his neighbor's been murdered. Mrs. Dosberg comes out. She suddenly realizes the screams that she had heard weren't their television. It was Howard and Myra being murdered. So Harry describes the black man that he saw hitchhiking, and he knew that another local farmer had given that guy a ride. And so he said, yeah, Jarvis Wireman gave that guy a ride. Go talk to him. So they go over to Jarvis Wireman's house. Jarvis Wireman says, yeah, and McCoy was with me. Go over and talk to McCoy. So they go to the other farmer's house, and they show him pictures of Buchanan, and he says, yeah, that's the guy. That's the guy that was in the truck with us. And they go to the next store up the road to Millville, where Buchanan had gotten a ride to from this Jarvis Wireman. And he identifies him. He says, yeah, that's the guy that was in the store. And he got a ride from Wireman over to Mason. So they go over to Mason, and they notify the Mason police, and everybody's starting to be on edge. And suddenly they realize that the killer took a cab from Mason into Lansing to the Lansing bus station. Now the police have nowhere to search. He could be anywhere. The bus people didn't remember him. They didn't remember Neely Buchanan coming in and buying a ticket. So the police had nothing. Their trail turned cold at that point.
We can use this as an opportunity to just stop for a second, Rod, to talk about Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. And Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States, and as a result, seafood is sourced sustainably, beef, chicken, and pork come from responsibly raised animals, and produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. Blue Apron can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. It's affordable. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with the pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. You can choose from a variety of new recipes each week or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not separated within a year, so you'll never get bored. It's flexible, so you can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences, and Blue Apron has several delivery options so you can choose what fits your needs, and there's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, trust me, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned fresh ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. It also has a Blue Apron freshness guarantee, promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, fresh, or they'll make it right. Now, the featured upcoming meals this week include the basil pesto chicken with the summer vegetable panzanella. I tried that. It was fantastic. I loved it. Panzanella is kind of like a salad with bread and tomatoes. But the spices, the combination for the basil pesto chicken were fantastic. And they also tried the sautéed shrimp and green beans with the globe tomatoes, spinach, and orzo pasta, that little rice pasta. Fantastic. I loved it. I put it together myself, and like I say, easy to put together gourmet cooking done by me. You can do it. It's fantastic, fresh, and unbelievable gourmet cooking made by me at home. Now check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/murder. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create your own incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/murder. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now, we have the discovery of Myra and Howard Herrick. We also have the police hot on the trail of Neely Buchanan. And as you say, they have no idea. But Neely Buchanan starts a new life in another city using the identity of Howard Herrick. So tell us what he does, where does he go, and how does he rebuild his new life? How is that possible? What does he do?
Well, he took Howard Herrick's identification. Back then, Howard Herrick carried a Social Security card. His driver's license didn't have his picture on it, nor his description. It was just his name. And so Buchanan took those. And by the time that the bodies were found, Buchanan was already in New York using Howard Herrick's name. He had taken the cab to Mason, or I'm sorry, he had gotten a ride to Mason from Jarvie Wireman. He'd taken the cab to Lansing, and he grabbed a bus. Originally, he was going to go to Chicago. He figured he would just mix in Chicago. Unfortunately, the bus to Chicago was going to leave later than he wanted to hang around. And so he took the bus to New York, which was actually a little further away. And he ended up just staying in a flop house for a couple days and finding quick work. He was using Howard Herrick's name. The one mistake that Buchanan made was he sent a postcard to his wife, and he, even though he hadn't seen her in several years, he just wanted her to know that he was okay. Well, she quickly turned that over to the police, and they saw the New York City postmark. So New York City detectives are looking for a double murderer. They're looking for Neely Buchanan, and they're in the Bowery, if you will. They're looking in all the flop houses. Neely Buchanan comes back from work one day, and this is just within a couple days of the bodies being found. And he hears a couple of the transients talking about how the police had been in there looking for a guy named Neely Buchanan. Well, they only knew him as Howard Herrick because that was the name that he was using. So he figured he better get out of Dodge, if you will. So Buchanan decides he's going to head to either North or South Carolina, and I have to apologize, I don't remember exactly, but he's only got enough money to get to Baltimore. And so he takes the bus to Baltimore, and he works a couple quick jobs and finally settles into a job at a paper company And that's where he ends up working and continues to work until that fateful day when he's discovered.
Now, before we get back to his life, we get back to the response in Stockbridge, the media response. Tell us about how much fear is instilled by this crime and the media response, and how far that media response, before we talk about Harry Doesburg's extraordinary effort on behalf of his friends.
Well, the best way to describe it is a term used by one of the newspaper reporters, and I used it as a chapter title in my book to describe the air, if you will, in Stockbridge after the murders. And it was literally a fog of fear. People that once left their doors unlocked and met strangers with a handshake now locked their doors, locked their homes, loaded up on guns, new locks. Everybody feared that Neely Buchanan was hiding somewhere in their barn or in their outbuildings, or that he would break into their homes. Kids were being taught how to use shotguns. There was a photo in one of the papers that I found that showed a woman who was teaching her 15-year-old daughter how to use a double-barrel shotgun and while her 11-year-old friend looked on. There was an elderly woman who literally put a revolver in her refrigerator, figuring that if Buchanan broke in and wanted food, she would reach in the refrigerator to get food for him and pull out the revolver and shoot him. The hardware stores in Stockbridge, they were running out of ammunition and guns, and they were running out of locks. Everybody was fearful. There was a salesman from a nearby community who was going door to door selling vacuum cleaners. And everybody kept reporting him that there was a strange guy knocking on doors. People wouldn't answer their doors. They were so fearful. The salesman actually went out and was tired and laid down in the brush near a field, and somebody saw him do that, so they called the police, and they quickly swooped in and determined that he wasn't the killer, obviously. But people were calling in sightings down in Detroit. They were there was a prison guard who was certain that he saw Buchanan driving through Jackson. Another ex-inmate from the prison said he was sure that Buchanan had broken out to get him. The fear was just overwhelming, and it continued for several months. To this day, I'll tell you a little side note to this. To this day, people still have changed their lives because of that. And I'll give you an example. I was talking to a local principal here in Eaton County, and he told me that they always locked their vehicles. And after that murder, his dad parked a Jeep out by their barn, and he left the keys in it and left the doors unlocked, figuring that if an escapee came after that murder, he could jump in the vehicle and take off. So people's entire lives were changed because of that double murder. And I think to this day they were, or they are. I know that the children of Howard and Myra Herrick, their lives were changed forever. They were in fear for the rest of their lives that Buchanan was going to get out of prison and come back and kill them. It changed the way that people lived back then.
Now, you talk about a very heroic person in this Howard Doesburg, and he had been friends with the Herricks. And what does he do? When does he undertake on their behalf And how far does he go with this? What's the extent of his involvement and his persistence in this? What does he do?
Harry Doesburg owned the little grocery store right across from the Herricks, and that's where Howard had gotten his gasoline. And of course, Mrs. Doesburg heard the murder going on and didn't realize it, which actually gave Buchanan a two-day head start. I think that probably had a lot to do with what Harry Doesburg chose to do. The local township officials offered a $500 reward for information leading to the arrest of Neely Buchanan. Harry Doesburg took it upon himself to raise that reward beyond that $500 mark. He went door to door in the community during the evenings, asking people to donate to the reward fund. Harry Doesburg took a lot of his own money, and he had wanted posters made. And people would stop into his store, people passing through on State Highway M-92, and he would hand out what they called the bundles for Buchanan. And they were stacks of wanted posters. And he simply asked them to drop them off at restaurants or gas stations or wherever they were going, just to get word out there, because the police investigation had come to a standstill. And Harry continued his quest. He actually contacted every police agency in the United States and made sure that they had a wanted poster, including some police agencies in Canada, all the federal agencies. He really was a one-man crusade to catch the killer of his neighbors. There were times where he would send out over $100 in mailings of his own money. He had wanted ads for Neely Buchanan put in magazines that were geared toward African Americans, because he figured that Buchanan was probably hiding in a big city amongst the black community in an effort to hide. And so he took it upon himself to do that, and he got the reward raised to $3,000, and then continued mailing these things out with his own money. And it literally, I'm telling you right now, it literally was a one-man campaign to catch that killer.
Now, you talk about Neely's life in Baltimore, and just an odd, again, very fascinating event where a girlfriend is reading a detective magazine. And again, this is how far Harry Doesburg goes with trying to push this story and get this and raise awareness, as they say now, in terms of this crime nationwide. So she's reading a detective magazine. What does she do when she sees that? And talk about that confrontation as you do in the book.
She confronts him. She sees the wanted ad, and I think that I have to apologize. I don't know. I couldn't find out if she was actually reading the same magazine that the next guy was, but she sees a wanted ad and she recognizes Neely Buchanan, and she confronts him. It's she's seeing him or dating him, if you will. And he says, "Oh, no, that's not me. That's not me." He convinces her that it's not him, because he now has a mustache. In the wanted poster, he doesn't. He says, "No, that's not me." And she believes him. She believes him. And this is in Baltimore. So a couple weeks later, another guy is looking through a magazine called Bronze Thrills. And it's a pulp fiction, sort of a true crime, true detective type magazine. And it's written for black people. It's geared toward African Americans. And he's looking through his issue of Bronze Thrills, and he spots Neely Buchanan's wanted poster. He thinks the reward is $300. He's been in prison himself for assault, but he can use the money. And he had met Buchanan about a month before that in a bar, and they had something in common. That's what made him remember him, because they both lived on Bond Street. In Baltimore, So he flags down a couple patrolmen. He sees one of the patrolmen that he knows, and he flags down him and his partner and tells him about it. Well, he shows them the wanted ad, and they're like, sure. I can tell you right now, if somebody told me that, I'd probably say, well, let's go check it out, but the chances that it's him are probably slim to none. So they confront Neely Buchanan in a candy store. Buchanan sees him coming, and he steps into a candy store hoping that they won't see him. They step in right after him, and they confront him. They've seen the wanted ad. And the wanted ad says that he's killed a guy named Howard Herrick. So they confront him in the candy store. They ask him, what's your name? Howard Herrick. He tells them his name is Howard Herrick. They know they've got their man. They ask him for some identification. All he's got with him is some pay stubs from the Bohega Paper Company where he was working with the name Howard Herrick on it. And so they keep pressing him right in the candy store, and finally he says, you know what, you got me. He says, I escaped from prison in Michigan. I was wanted for B&E, or for breaking and entering. And Officer Zukowski says to him, he says, did you hurt anybody? Because he knows he killed him. And Buchanan finally says, yeah. He says, I killed those two people in Michigan. And so he's arrested literally without incident, and he's taken to the Baltimore City Jail. And he's interviewed there by some detectives. And he makes a statement, and the Ingham County Sheriff is notified immediately. The next morning, they fly out of Willow Run Airport in Detroit and fly to Baltimore, and they take two deputies with them. The sheriff takes two deputies. He takes Harry Dosberg, because Harry's got the reward money, and he takes a reporter from the local paper called the Ingham County Democrat. And they get to Baltimore, and the next morning, they pick up their prisoner, and they're on their way back to Michigan. And that evening, or that afternoon when they return, they interview Buchanan. And he makes a complete confession, and he describes in vivid detail how he killed Howard and Myra Herrick and what his intentions were. He's interviewed by the chief assistant prosecuting attorney and the sheriff and another prosecuting attorney. And he makes this statement. They take him over to be arraigned before the local justice of the peace so that he can hear the charges against him. At that point, he's offered what's called a preliminary examination, which is like a mini trial. The prosecution simply has to show that a crime was committed and there's reason to believe that Buchanan had committed it. Buchanan says, nope, I'll waive my preliminary examination. I just want to get this over with. So the justice of the peace, he says, your case is bound over to the circuit court. You'll go before the circuit court in the morning for your arraignment there. So they take him to Lansing the next morning. He's arraigned before a circuit court judge. And the judge says to him, you have the right to have an attorney present. This is in 1956 now. You have the right to have an attorney present. But if you can't afford one, the court will appoint one for you. And the judge continues on. The judge never asks him, would you like an attorney? Buchanan just stands there quietly and says, I want to get this over with. I plead guilty. So the judge says, we have to have a hearing to determine the degree of murder. They call it a degree of guilt hearing. So the judge calls in the sheriff, the medical examiner, calls in a few other witnesses, and it takes about 2 hours, and the judge determines that it's first-degree murder. And he sets the sentencing within the next hour. So Buchanan comes back for the sentencing after the degree hearing, and he gets sentenced to life in prison. The judge does not say to him before the sentencing, you have the right to have an attorney present. The judge doesn't say that. The judge is not required to say that. After the after Buchanan pled guilty and before the degree hearing, it was common practice for a judge to take the defendant back into his chambers and question him about why he's guilty, so that he believes that the defendant is actually pleading guilty because he is guilty, if that makes sense to you.
Right.
He does it one-on-one with Buchanan. There's nobody else in the court chambers. And it only takes a few minutes. Buchanan explains why he's guilty. The judge comes back out and says, I believe that he is guilty. I don't believe he's been coerced or threatened in any way, and we'll have the sentencing next. And so they have the sentencing, and from the time of his arrest to the time that he's on his way back to Jackson Prison is less than 72 hours. From Baltimore to getting back in Jackson Prison, just that quick.
And you
the
say
community
he also
is elated.
Sorry,
I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead.
I was just going to say the community is elated. The killer's in custody. Harry Doesburg is a hero. He paid out the reward to the two officers that made the arrest and to the guy that turned in Buchanan, and actually made a donation to the Baltimore Police Benevolent Society as a part of it. So everybody's happy. The killer's in custody, and he's been sentenced to two life terms back in prison.
I just wanted to mention, too, the confession that he gives to Sheriff Barnes is part of this trial as well, and also helped establish the degree of murder as well, which included deliberation, which included premeditation, and which included intent to kill, correct?
Right, and the way that they determined that is because they specifically asked him about the chopping block that was placed in the rafters. And they said, what were you going to do with that? And he said, I was going to push it off, and it would have killed Mr. Herrick. So that was a key issue in the confession, and that helped the judge make the determination that, in fact, he had planned on killing Mr. Herrick. What came up in later years was the question, well, did he actually go into the barn to commit murder? That wasn't his intent. He was trying to escape with the car. And that became a huge issue later during some of the appeals.
Now, you talk about at the trial, all four of the Herrick couple's children were in attendance for that verdict. And you also talk about Michigan State concerning the death penalty. Tell us what the state of the death penalty was in Michigan.
There was none. Michigan was one of the first states in the 1830s to abolish the death penalty. It came as a result of a gentleman who had beat his wife unmercifully and killed her because he suspected that she was cheating on him. He was taken to Detroit. He was given a trial, and he was sentenced to hang in public, a public execution. And I can't think of the term that I'm looking for. The gentleman that put the show together, if you will, actually had a grandstands built around the gallows. Had a military band as an honor guard, had a vendor selling food. It was more of a carnival atmosphere for this public execution. And when it was over, the public was disgusted by what they saw. And that really turned the tide toward executions in Michigan. And it was a few years later when the Michigan legislature abolished it. So Michigan had not had a death penalty since the 1830s. And while the Herrick children would have loved to have had that penalty imposed, it wasn't going to happen. The judge could do, Judge Salmon, was to sentence him to two life terms in prison. And Judge Salmon made the statement at the sentencing. He said, I believe that if you were released, you would kill again.
Wow. You say that he was ensconced in a 6-by-9-foot cell. He was transferred to Marquette, Michigan. But after 10 years, 1966, Buchanan was wondering if there was something in his case that he could appeal. And as you talk about in the book, there are numerous jailhouse lawyers. Tell us a little bit about, for those that don't know, what a jailhouse lawyer really does do and can do, and what Neely Buchanan began doing on behalf of his case.
A jailhouse lawyer literally is just another inmate who has studied in the law libraries and literally helps the other inmates write their appeals. They don't go to court for them. Obviously, they're inmates in the prison, but they simply they assist them in doing research and writing appeals based on certain things that they might find that could help get a conviction overturned. In Neely's case, he waited for 10 years. He didn't begin his appeals until 1966. And he had to begin those appeals with the local courts in Ingham County. Judge Salmon quickly denied his appeal. It was denied each time it moved into the next phase of the judicial system. The local courts, the Court of Appeals, the Michigan Supreme Court, every time it was denied. And it lingered in the courts each time. I have to back up just a little bit and let you know that in the previous arrest prior to the murder, Buchanan had never had an attorney represent him. He always just pled guilty. Never hired an attorney, was never appointed an attorney. That was not the practice back in the early 50s. And even as he appealed his cases after the murder, 10 years after the murder, the only attorney he ever had was an attorney in the Lansing area who literally simply filed some papers for him, never really appeared in court for him. He never appeared before a judge for any type of an appeal. And once that particular appeal was denied, that was the last that he ever saw that attorney. So up until 1981, 26 years after the murder, Neely Buchanan had literally never been represented by an attorney in any court proceedings until he filed an appeal with the federal courts claiming violations of the 14th Amendment and I think the 6th Amendment. And he was given a new evidentiary hearing to determine the degree of guilt or the degree of murder. They were going to attempt to determine if it was first-degree murder or second-degree murder, or if it was manslaughter, 26 years later after the murder. The Herricks had moved on with their life, or the Herrick children had moved on with their lives, and subsequently he was actually given, a judge overturned that, reversed the decision earlier and said that he should be given a new preliminary examination to determine the degree of guilt. The evidentiary hearing determined whether or not he should be given a new preliminary examination, and he was going to be given that. And he was appointed an attorney, that was the attorney that I met with in Detroit, who argued for Neely, saying that clearly this is not first-degree murder. This is easily second-degree murder or manslaughter. And the state's attorney general's office represented the people and fought to keep Neely Buchanan in jail, saying that this guy waited 25 years to file a federal appeal. No, time's up. Time out. It's gone beyond the stages of time. He referred to it as the doctrine of latches, which means that the time has run out. You had your chance to file your appeals years ago, and you never did. And the judges, they voted in favor of the preliminary examination, giving him a new preliminary examination. Well, the state's attorney general's office appealed to the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court was scheduled to hear Neely Buchanan's case in 1984, or early 1985. They were going to hear Neely Buchanan's case, and these issues were going to be settled. For a case to be heard by the United States Supreme Court, there's some major law that's going to be decided. And that was the case for Neely Buchanan. He was going to get his day, and he likely would have been released.
Now tell us about his health and how his health affects his decision-making and hence this case.
Well, Neely discovered in the early 80s that he had some internal bleeding, and it was determined through some exploratory surgery that he had developed colon cancer. And the doctors knew that there was nothing that they could do for him, that it was a terminal case. Neely never told his attorney that he had cancer. His attorney went to the prison for a consultation in the early 80s and said, "I'm here to see my client." And they said, "Well, he's not here." Well, Neely's attorney said, "Well, where's he at?" "Well, we can't tell you where he's at." "What do you mean you can't tell me? I'm here for a attorney-client meeting." So the prison guard did some check-in, and they finally told him that Neely was in the hospital. So the attorney went and met with him, and as soon as he saw him, he knew Neely would never, he'd never walk out of prison, never, ever walk out of prison. He knew that Neely was going to die. Neely's health began to deteriorate. At one point, he called for a friend of his. I say friend, a man that he had known through his entire prison life, who had begun in 1955 as a prison counselor, worked his way up through the ranks, and was now the director for the Michigan Department of Corrections, and asked to see him. They had run into each other for years. Even the prison director knew that Neely was not a threat to society, but he knew that society would never accept him back in their ranks because he had killed two people. And Neely, basically laying on his deathbed in his cell, said, "Hey, things are going good. My case is going to be heard before the Supreme Court. Could you get a hold of Frank," meaning the Attorney General Frank Kelly, "and see what you can do for me?" Well, the director knew better. Like I said, he knew that there's no way Neely would ever kill anybody because he was an old man now, but he knew society would never accept it. And so he told Neely, he said, "I'm sorry, but there's nothing I can do for you." And it was shortly thereafter that he'd received word that Neely Buchanan had died in prison, literally months before his case was to be heard by the United States Supreme Court.
Incredible. Now, you talk about the interviews for this book, and you said you had interviews with, I believe, Frank Eamon, his attorney. Tell us a little bit about what he thought personally about the case, not professionally, and or what you determined he felt about the case personally rather than professionally.
Well, I think personally, although it was only a few years that he was associated with Neely Buchanan, he was affected by Buchanan in the sense that he saw a senior citizen who regretted what he had done 26 years in prison. And actually, by the time he passed away in prison, it was close to 30 years. He'd done 30 years in prison and deeply regretted the decision he'd made in killing Howard and Myra Herrick. When he discovered that Neely had cancer, He went out to his car and sobbed, just cried. I couldn't believe he told me that, but he did. He said, and I don't know if I was crying for Neely or if I was crying for my dad who had passed away from cancer. So Neely Buchanan deeply affected Frank Kieman. And Frank's stance in the end and to this day is, was Neely Buchanan the same man in 1984 that he was in 1955? And Frank would argue, no, he wasn't. He wasn't. Eric Egan, the assistant attorney general who handled the case for the state, fought to keep Neely in prison. Were there some issues that needed to be addressed by the Supreme Court? Absolutely. Was the attorney general's office worried about decisions that the Supreme Court might make? Absolutely, absolutely they were, but they needed those issues resolved. Otherwise, they'd be brought up again and again and again in other cases. So they needed some case law. So yeah, they were worried about it. I asked Eric Egan. I said, when you found out that Neely passed away, I said, what were your thoughts? He said, there was no joy. There was no joy. He said, we wanted that case to go before the Supreme Court so that some case law could be made. And he said, there was no joy when Neely Buchanan died. He said he called one of the Herrick children, the daughter, and he said, you know, he told her that Neely had passed away. And he said there was no joy for her. It was just a sad case from beginning to end. It really was. And there was no celebrations.
I think the only bright spot is the dedicated police that were on this case, but also the heroic, as I mentioned, Harry Doesburg and his extraordinary effort. And then, again, the very movie-esque, somebody reading a detective magazine and this story being featured, and you had the radio program Gangbusters, again, equivalent of America's Most Wanted or something. So very extraordinary effort from a small town and a guy that had a general store. He wasn't incredibly wealthy or anything, but what he did and its result was an incredible part of your book. I want to thank you very much, Rod, for coming on and speaking about A Slayer Waits, the true story of a Michigan double murder. For those that might want to take a look at your work, is there a website, Facebook page? How can they contact you or look at your other work?
You can find me on Facebook under Rod Sadler Author, RODSADLER Author, Rod Sadler Author. And I also have a Twitter page, and I enjoy new readers, and I love to share stories. I got to tell you real quick, after the book came out, I was contacted by some relatives of Harry Doesburg's that I didn't know existed, and it was such a joy to talk to them because they didn't know that particular part of the story. They didn't know what their grandfather had done, and they told me that they actually have a letter from J. Edgar Hoover written to Harry Doesburg after the capture.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah, very impressive. That was fun to talk to them. So, but thank you for having me on your show. I really appreciate it, Dan.
Thank you very much. It's been fascinating. Thank you very much, Rod, for this. And you have a great evening and hope to talk to you again soon on your new release. Thank you very much. Have a great evening.
Great. Thank you, Dan.
Good night.
Good night.